It's All About Food with Karen Hartglass, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. It's all about food. Thanks for joining me today. And remember, you can always call in because this is a live show. We have a really interesting show for you, and if you have any comments or questions, you can call in at 1-888-874-4888. Okay. We've got David Kirby on the show, the author of Animal Factory. David Kirby wrote the award-winning New York Times bestseller, Evidence of Harm, Mercury in Vaccines and the Autism Epidemic, a Medical Controversy, back in 2005. And Evidence of Harm sparked a national debate in private homes, leading universities, and the halls of Congress. And Kirby has appeared on such venues as Meet the Press, Larry King Live, The Today Show, I Miss in the Morning, Montel Williams, Air America, and dozens of local radio and television stations. Kirby has also been interviewed by and reviewed outlets such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, USA Today, Associated Press, Financial Times, Bloomberg, Newsday, The Lancet, Salon.com, and more. Kirby, a charter contributor to the Huffington Post since its founding in 2005, has been a professional journalist for over 15 years. Kirby has also written for a number of national magazines. In addition, he was a foreign correspondent in Mexico and Central America from 1986 to 1990, where he covered the wars in El Salvador and Nicaragua and covered politics, corruption, and natural disasters in Mexico. He's also done extensive consulting with the United Nations Development Program's Human Development Report Office. Kirby has also worked in politics, medical research, and public relations. He worked for New York City Council President Carol Bellamy as a special assistant for health care, cultural affairs, and civil rights, followed by employment as chief scheduler to Manhattan Borough President David Dinkins. He also was a senior staff advisor to Dinkins' successful 1989 run for mayor of New York City. And it goes on and on and on and on. And David Kirby lives in Brooklyn, and he has a website, which I invite you to check, animalfactorybook.com. Please welcome the amazing David Kirby, who is sitting right across from me, and I'm just in awe. Welcome.
Thank you, Karen. I got tired just listening to all of that. I forgot I'd done all that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's good to hear it.
Thank you for that.
You know, it's good to hear it because when we work so hard, we deserve some pats on the back. And I think some of the work that you've done does not always get loud cheers.
No, not all of it.
Yeah.
I'm used to that, though.
Okay, so you have this book, Animal Factory, which came out last year and now is out or coming out in paperback.
Today, paperback.
Oh.
March 16th.
Congratulations. Thank today.
You.
Whoa. Everybody run out and get your copy, Animal Factory. So when I first got a press release for this book, I thought, okay, I'm going to read another one of these books about factory farming. And, yeah, we need as many books about factory farming as we can get out in front of people because everybody's got to know it. Everybody's got to be thinking about it because it's got to change. But I didn't think it was going to be the book that it was. And It was a very enjoyable read, despite the subject. What I liked about it was you really put a very human face. These were individual human stories that you were talking about related to how animals are raised and how this mass production of animals is really devastating to our health, to our neighborhoods, to the economy, and it was almost like a thriller sometimes reading it. I think it would make a great film. Does someone have the movie rights?
Not yet. For sale.
And then, I mean, we'll talk about all of this, but and then the lack of government helping in this situation, even when there really are regulations. So, I recommend really reading it. And again, the website is animalfactorybook.com. So one thing, when a lot of us talk about factory farming and about animal exploitation, people always say, well, you only care about animals. You don't care about humans. So can you tell me why the two are connected or how the two are connected?
Yes, and my book is about humans, despite the name Animal Factory. I touch upon human or animal welfare in the book because it is related to this way of producing food. But people, A, want to read about people, and I think as concerned as people are about animal welfare, ultimately the health and survival of our own species is also...
Yeah, it's number one.
Yeah, it's number one. It may sound selfish, but I'd rather live, personally.
I always like to make the point that it's all connected.
Well, it is all connected. And I just completed an article for the Humane Society magazine, All Animals, looking at the different ways that factory farming impacts human health and public health negatively.
Right.
And even though I had written about it in the book and I've been writing about it on Huffington Post, I never really sat down and just made out a full inventory of all the ways that this form of production can make us sick. And there were so many, I actually had to divide them up into three categories. One being communicable diseases.
Oh.
So viruses, influenza virus, MRSA, which is drug-resistant staph bacteria. Things that the workers themselves would carry out of the factory farm and spread in the community person to person. That's one type of disease.
And we hardly ever hear about that.
No, but it's out there, and we can talk about it. Number two is environmental diseases. In other words, diseases that come from pollution, whether it's air pollution from the off-gassing of this huge concentration of manure and urine, which is typically kept in a liquefied form so that it undergoes anaerobic decomposition, in which case it off-gasses tons, literally, of ammonia, methane, hydrogen sulfide, other things that can make you very sick. It can also leach nitrates and other dangerous things into the groundwater, into the drinking water. It can also release pathogens, deadly bacteria, into the air, and drug-resistant bacteria into the air.
These are all new, separate subjects you could write about.
That's why my book is so long. And, you know, the pollution, the air and water pollution everywhere I went was always the biggest concern, particularly the air pollution, not only the foul odors, but the way it makes you sick when you breathe in. You get what's called manure flu. I got it when I was out in the Western Dairies in California and Washington State, breathing this air. It's hot, it's dry. The feces get ground up into dust, and then when the wind comes, you breathe this stuff in, and it makes you sick. The EPA just came out with some data that was just analyzed by the Environmental Integrity Project. And according to them, using the EPA data of air monitoring data from these CAFOs, these factory farms, the air quality is worse than it is around oil refineries.
Wow.
So you can get sick breathing the air around or drinking the water around a factory farm. And then finally, the third way is the foodborne illnesses, E. coli, salmonella, and other diseases that factory farm food often is more likely to contain.
And we hear about that pretty regularly.
Well, there's an E. coli recall just about every week. and there was the huge salmonella recall last summer with 2.5 billion eggs, something like that. Half a billion eggs, excuse me. And these all virtually all come from factory farm settings. That doesn't mean that organic, grass-fed, pasture-fed meat, milk, and eggs is immune from E. coli or salmonella. But the studies seem to indicate that factory farm products are more likely.
Anytime you have a bug and you're in a confined, dirty situation, it's going to spread.
Yes.
Density equals...
Yes.
Disaster.
One reason colds and flus are more prevalent in the winter is because we spend more time indoors. Now, the cold weather will also weaken your immune system.
And the air is dry and the...
Things just get past them. We spend more time together in the wintertime.
Okay. So Did we hit on all the this whole list? It's
Of the ways that these can make you sick, yes, although there's other ways too. You know, there's heavy metals in these meats. Between the drug residue, the pathogens themselves, and the heavy metals that are residues, it's getting harder and harder for U.S. producers to export meat to overseas countries. Mm-hmm. If you want to sell hogs to Japan, I guess they won't be importing much for a while, but you need to wean your hogs off of antibiotics 4 weeks before slaughter.
Wow.
Russia just banned pork from Smithfield and Tyson plants.
Nice.
Because of salmonella, listeria, and drug residue. Mexico has turned back shipments of beef because the copper levels are too high. They exceed Mexican standards. We have no copper standards for our beef. So that meat was turned around and sold in the United States. In fact,
probably to the school lunch program or something like that.
Well, that's where a lot of the really low-quality stuff goes.
Yep.
Yeah,
our kids in America. Thank you.
And then I just found out we have a problem selling beef to Taiwan. I think it's beef. It might be no pork, because we use a product that I had never even heard of before, called paylean. P A Y L E A N. Two important words
paylean.
To a hog.
Paylean. Uh-huh.
Pay for lean, which converts fat into leaner muscle protein.
Oh, aren't they going to give that to humans soon?
Well, if you eat pork, apparently you're eating it
least
in small amounts, and it's not good for the heart. So there's other ways that...
Well, pork isn't good for the heart either.
Well, it can okay. be very delicious.
We're not going to talk about that. Right. So, okay. So what's clear about the book is you're talking about factory farming and how it's not good for humans. And what's really compelling is there are a number of stories. I read it a while ago, so I forget how many, three or four.
There's three main stories.
And you follow these individual stories, and it's heartbreaking, and you learn a lot along the way with these individual stories. So I don't want to give away the book, but one of the things that just was so heart-wrenching to me was this story about the lagoons always leaking. Let's talk about lagoons.
Sure.
And, you know, I'm thinking... The focus this week is on what happened in Japan, which is, and there are no words to describe what's going on there, and we don't know what's going to happen. But there are things that happen. We had this disaster in Haiti. We had a disaster with the BP oil spill. We had the disaster with Katrina years ago. There's always stuff going on, and it's heartbreaking, and somehow we survive, some of us, and get through it. But we have these disasters going on a daily basis in our own country. And what would happen if we had an earthquake or something with these lagoons that are not really regulated and are overflowing with muck? And what's the deal with these lagoons, and how do people get away with them? How did they get started?
Well, they're the cheapest, easiest way to manage millions and millions of gallons of waste. And when you confine thousands of pigs or cows or chickens into a single confinement, you're creating far more manure than the land around you can absorb. So you have to store it until you figure out what to do with it, which usually means distribute it over a very large area of land. And like I said before, because it's liquefied, you have to do something with it, and they basically dig a hole in the ground and put it in there. Now, the technology has improved. There are synthetic liners and things like that, and different states have different requirements. But even a synthetic liner leaks small amounts. And, you know, the state says, well, the lagoon can leak 1/16th of an inch per day, which may not sound like much at all. But on an 11-acre lagoon, that's a lot of wastewater seeping into mm-hmm. the ground. And then when the farmer goes to apply this liquid waste to his land, he or she often overapplies it to the point where it also saturates and seeps down into the ground and gets in the groundwater or runs off into creeks and rivers and forms algae blooms and causes fish kills. The lagoons themselves, and I think in all three places I write about, Yakima Valley, Washington, western Illinois, around Peoria and North Carolina in the Hog Belt, lagoons were a major issue, not only seepage, but overtopping, breaching, spilling, and very often in bad weather conditions. There's a story of Karen Hudson, who lives in Elmwood, Illinois, and her neighbor wanted to put in a 1,200-cow dairy. She tried to talk him out of it. He did it anyway. He dug his lagoon. And that winter, a couple years later, there was so much rain and snow. And, of course, when the ground is frozen, you cannot apply your liquid waste to the ground, which is a good law to have because it's going to immediately run off into the creek. So the ground was frozen. He couldn't apply it, but there was so much snow and rain coming in that his lagoon got higher and higher and higher, and it got up to about 2 inches from the rim. And the state did go out there, and they said, you have to do something about this. You have to truck it out of here. You have to lower. You're supposed to have at least a foot or two between your surface.
Safety margin.
Safety margin for this exact reason. He didn't do that. And he panicked, and he got two hoses, each a mile long, and he ran them way out across the fields to a ravine that happened to have an earthen berm at the end of it, and he pumped 5 million gallons of putrid, stinking, brown and yellow cow waste into this ravine. And, of course, it continued to rain, and the berm didn't hold. And that all went spilling eventually into Kickapoo Creek, which spilled into the Illinois River, right at the spot where Peoria gets its drinking water.
Mm.
And from there, it went into the Mississippi River and eventually added to all of the nutrients from all of the runoff in the Midwest, from Montana to Pennsylvania, all drains out through New Orleans. And you mentioned the BP oil spill, and everybody was up in arms, and now we have baby dolphins turning up dead on the shore there. They don't know if it's from the oil spill.
Oh, gosh. Mm-hmm.
But every summer, there's a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico the size of New Jersey.
Right.
And we don't talk about that. Nope. The media doesn't fly down. You don't see Anderson Cooper down there in the summertime. Rachel Maddow, they were there for the oil spill because it was dramatic. But I would guess, possibly, not to defend BP, that more marine life dies each summer in the dead zone.
And it's getting bigger.
Every year.
Mm-hmm.
Because of these nutrients running off and the lagoon. You know, that lagoon spill did, in its tiny little way, contribute to this dead zone. There's no question.
You have some talking points that come with your book. So it says U.S. animal factories yield 100 times more waste than all human sewage plants.
Yes, and it's untreated.
And it's untreated. That's the important thing. We have to treat our human waste, but not the animal waste.
And their waste is much more pathogenic than ours. I mean, ours is pretty bad,
mm-hmm.
but hog waste contains stuff that will just kill you.
How do they get away with this? Why isn't it regulated?
Well, it is regulated, but it's really state by state and sometimes almost county by county. And in states that are pro-agriculture, by the way, what's the five biggest agricultural states in the country are California, Texas, Illinois, New York, and Florida, which happen to be the five most populous states as well.
Mm-hmm.
We don't think of New York as being a big agricultural state,
no.
but it is.
You know, yeah,
obviously,
upstate New York.
You know, mm-hmm. California certainly is, Texas certainly is, Illinois certainly is. And even though, with the exception of Texas and possibly Florida, you know, we consider those
the liberal states, the blue states,
blue-green states, you know. Washington State, Northwest Eco Paradise,
mm-hmm.
they're horrible with the dairies. They let the dairies run roughshod, and they own Olympia, and it's disgusting. The amount of corruption, the amount of payoff, the amount of influence that these big ag companies have. And, of course, the politicians just think, well, geez, without the dairy industry, Washington State would be in bigger trouble. There's a lot of self-policing. There's a lot of laws on the books, but no enforcement. Washington State, when I had that, they had, I think, one or two inspectors for the entire central region of Washington State, which is a big area. They might visit a factory farm once every 10 years.
Well, it all comes down to profit, obviously. And this is all under the rug or whatever because people are making money and people want to have an economy for their area. But we've seen, and you talk about it in your book too, when these when somebody wants to put an animal factory in a community, we see ultimately that it destroys the community economy. That company may benefit, but everyone else suffers.
That has happened, yes. Typically, when they want to site one of these things, they go to try to find the poorest, most rural, most uneducated, least affluent county.
That's nice.
That they can. In North Carolina, virtually all the hog CAFOs are in the most African-American counties,
mm-hmm.
with the lowest income, where people have very little political participation. When they complain, they get harassed by the law enforcement. In Yakima Valley, not a wealthy area, and a lot of low-income Latino and Native American people live there. So, again, political participation is limited, and political power is limited. And in other areas, in all three, and in areas that are largely white, middle-class, rural, such as in Illinois and the Midwest, in all three cases, whether it's Latino, Native American, a white community, or an African-American community, these companies underestimate these communities,
mm-hmm.
and they think they can come in and just do what they want, and they don't expect a backlash. They don't expect people. And my book is about, and I mention people in all those communities who rallied to the cause and organized their communities and hired lawyers and went to county commissions and went to the state capitol and demonstrated and learned how to work the media and really learn how to fight these things at every level. And that's what the heart of Animal Factory.
Yeah,
is.
But it was a heart-wrenching story, and these people fought and fought and fought and fought and fought, and there weren't many victories.
There are victories. There's a lot
there
of defeats, and you know there have been reforms, and you know McDonald's doesn't buy antibiotic stuff anymore. Mm. I mean, the victories are different. You know, sometimes at the state level, sometimes at the consumer level. You know, Obama promised a million things when he was running and has failed on a lot of them, particularly in terms of the consolidation and vertical integration of the food industry, which is covered under the USDA. But on the environmental side, they've been very good. And, for example, out there in doing well water testing in Yakima Valley for nitrates, Helen Redout, who was the person I profiled out there, she organized with her neighbors and she sued all the dairies and they all settled, except for one, and he went to trial, and he lost big time.
Mm-hmm.
And hundreds of thousands of dollars were raised, and that all went to well water testing, which revealed very high nitrates, which got the EPA out there. So that's a victory.
That's good.
You
mm-hmm.
know, and the dairymen are not happy, you know? And so that is a victory. We see more movement towards an antibiotic ban, not allowing farmers to give antibiotics to healthy animals to make them grow faster.
But it's all connected, too, to the density, because they give it to them to grow faster, but they also give it to them to keep them from getting sick. But they're all so close together and poorly treated that how do you keep them well?
That's right. That's right. So, I mean, the victories, you know, they certainly have not, you know, there's no moratorium on these things. There's no outward ban. But there have been victories. And things slowly are getting better, but not entirely. I mean, and again, consumer awareness. I just want to mention, just you mentioned some of the heartbreaking stories. The African-American communities in North Carolina, some of those, I mean, it's just Jim Crow down there. It's,
yep.
You know, these are KKK counties, places where nobody ever goes. They are off the interstate. You would just never even know they exist. And I spent time there, and I talked to people whose families have been on those farms for 16 or generations since the Civil War, African American families, and their next door neighbor would put in a hog factory and just spray this waste, so that it was literally the spray was coming across onto their property, and coating everything in a filthy yellow film,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they were getting sick, and when they complained to the sheriff, they got arrested for harassment. So it just shows you how bad.
Yeah,
it can
history
be.
Just repeats itself in so many different ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was in North Carolina a couple years ago, and I realized, well, it was frustrating in a number of ways. I was in one of these food deserts where you couldn't find any healthy food. There were only these convenience stores, and there was really nothing to eat.
Yeah.
And I realized I was near, what is it called, Tar Heel? Tar Heel. Is that where the big slaughterhouses are?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And, of course, you couldn't see them. They're out of easy reach to find them intentionally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, of course, this waste, it's not just animal waste. It's not just natural animal waste. There's concentrated nitrates and chemicals from fertilizers and antibiotics and all of that, as you mentioned before, gets into the air, gets into the wastewater, and as a result, all kinds of problems, asthma. Children have birth defects or intelligence issues. There's all kinds of...
Asthma, yes. Autoimmune disorders can be exacerbated by nitrates. I'm not familiar with birth defects, but
okay.
I think air pollution in general can increase reproductive...
Well, maybe they haven't been confirmed, but
right.
People that have had miscarriages and...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, nitrates can absolutely cause spontaneous abortions, and I've met women who had several and then found out that their drinking water was very high. Look, swine flu. You mentioned the lagoons, the disease coming straight off the lagoons. There's a lot of evidence to show that the H1N1 currently... in circulation, which originally its ancestor appeared at a hog factory in North Carolina in 1998 and was out there circulating and nobody knew where it was and they were just waiting for it to jump back over to people. It looks like that happened in a Smithfield-owned facility in Veracruz, Mexico. And the neighbors, the people who lived around this, were complaining terribly about the flies coming off the lagoons, and we now know that these flies can be vectors of disease and can carry viruses, and it's very possible the flies or the workers brought this. Now, Smithfield denies this, but it sure seems to be ground zero of that epidemic, and so that was a disease that went either from the lagoon to the fly to the families, or from the lagoon or the hogs to the workers, to the families, but it doesn't, in either way, it jumps. Now they're talking about H2N2, which is circulating in pigs. It's a swine flu. The problem with H2N2 is they say that anybody who's 50 years or younger has never been exposed to this particular virus, so there's no natural immunity. So people in public health are very worried. They're actually talking about creating a vaccine even before it jumps.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think you're going to convince people to get vaccinated against a disease that does not
exist.
But one day it's going to happen. And
that just takes clever marketing. That's been done
before. We can talk about that on another show. The point is, have we really gotten to the point where we have to vaccinate ourselves against our own food supply? I mean, not your food supply in particular. But against a food supply, it's very scary.
Yeah, well, I like to quote my dad a lot. He has a saying, if you can't solve the problem, eliminate the problem. And I'm all for eliminating the problem. But a lot more to talk about here in the next half hour. We're going to take a very quick break, and we'll be right back.
Listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
This is Barry Farber with the best self-improvement advice you've ever had or ever heard. Learn a foreign language. Sounds impossible? Give me a chance to prove that I'm Barry Farber. I can guide you to mastery of any language in the world quickly, easily, inexpensively, and at home. You will grow culturally, linguistically, intellectually, commercially, professionally, even romantically. Get that smile off. Face it, happened to me. Listen to the Barry Farber Language Club for details. Wednesday mornings, right here on the Progressive Radio Network, every Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. beginning March 23rd.
Hey, Lee. Dad Jeff.
Your girlfriend gave another interview.
No, 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 don't play it.
Listen to this.
I have a journalism degree. That is what I studied. I understand that this cornerstone of our democracy is a free press.
Shut it off. I said not to play it.
We are in the worst reality show in history.
Why won't she shut up?
You know she's going to be president, right?
Okay, stop it. That's not funny. That's not funny.
I think we should just go limp. Lay back. Maybe then the mama grizzly won't tear off your limbs.
Cheater in the Rude. Thursdays, 8 p.m. Progressive Radio Network.
Don't miss out on Dr. Michio Kaku's weekly show, Explorations. Dr. Kaku is the only scientist with his own nationally syndicated radio show. Explorations is the program that explains complex physics with an accessible approach. So take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to discuss topics ranging from space exploration to stem cell research.
I'm Steve Lindman. I host the Progressive Radio News Hour. It's an in-depth truth hour, an antidote to government and corporate managed news and infotainment on the most important world and national issues affecting everyone. Distinguished guests are featured regularly to provide cutting-edge commentary and analysis not available from the dominant media, offering biased, irresponsible misinformation on what everyone needs to know. The Progressive Radio News Hour airs Thursdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, as well as Saturdays and Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, on the Progressive Radio Network, of course. Make it a regular habit and stay informed.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, and this is It's All About Food. I'm here with David Kirby, the author of Animal Factory, The Looming Threat of Industrial Pig, Dairy, and Poultry Farms to Humans and the Environment. And it just came out today in paperback. Grab your copy. Okay. Let's talk about poultry farms a little bit.
Okay.
Now, they don't make big, sloppy lagoon stuff of waste.
Typically, no, although I believe a lot of layer. There's broilers and layers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Two different chickens.
Things.
Which, by the way, on a traditional farm, a broiler and a layer is the same thing. you have a chicken lay eggs, and then when you're done, you eat the chicken. Here... You can eat
a layer
hen. You'll see it in the supermarket sometimes. It's fowl or hen or stewing hen. They're not very good eating.
Or they end up in soup.
In soup or frozen dinners, mm-hmm. Or dog food, things like that.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, after just popping out eggs every day of their life for a couple of years. So the layer operations sometimes liquefy their waste, but in a broiler operation, the waste literally becomes their home. It becomes their bedding. It becomes what's called their litter.
Recycling.
In a broiler house, which now can hold up to, I think it's something ridiculous, like 30, 40, 50,000 birds in a single confinement. And they will lay in several inches of bedding. Usually it's might be rice hulls with some hay or some twigs or some whatever. It's just organic material that they lay in as the bedding. And then as the chickens live in there, they poop. Birds do not urinate. I found out recently after writing this book. I guess the urine is mixed in with the... We don't need to get into it. But anyway, they defecate there in their own bedding. And at the end of the 7 or 8 week period, that's how long it... or how short it takes to grow a chicken for market in an industrial setting. There's like about 2 or 3 feet of cake. That's just a mixture of the original organic material and the feces. And, by the way, spilled feed, which often contains bovine products put into chicken feed. That bedding is then removed with a front loader and put on fields. Now, in the Chesapeake Bay area, the fields are so close to the water and there's so much tidal activity that the chicken litter gets into the water.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we have so much damage, or part of the reason there's so much damage being done in the Chesapeake Bay with algae blooms and fish kills and everything. In Arkansas, they were putting arsenic into the chicken feed. I believe in Maryland they still put arsenic in the chicken feed to prevent intestinal parasites and to make the birds grow faster. That litter was then being spread around towns, a little town, Prairie Grove in Arkansas, around the high school in the town, and about 20 kids in this town of about 2,000 people came down with cancer, including three 14-year-old boys in the same class who all had the same extremely rare form of testicular cancer. It attacks about 1 in 10 million men. And here were three boys in the same class.
And did anyone acknowledge that it was due to the arsenic?
There have been lawsuits, but so far they've all been unsuccessful. You got a county judge down there who's friendly with the chicken industry. Tyson owns Arkansas. No, that's not true, but it's difficult to get justice in a place like that. And chicken litter is so high in phosphorus, its land application uses are actually limited. So what are we going to do? Where do you put it? Every year there's enough chicken litter produced on the eastern shore of Maryland to fill an entire football stadium, including all the corridors and the snack bars and the bathroom. I mean, the entire thing would be filled solid.
So what do we do with it?
We feed it to cattle.
Oh, there we go.
We ship it off and we feed it to cattle, especially in areas where there's cattle growing near large chicken operations.
Now, of course, cows are supposed to be vegetarian, and I don't think they're meant to eat animal feces either.
Feces, no. Especially since that feces and that litter also contains bovine beef products.
Oh, mad cow disease.
So we're feeding cattle to cattle.
Which we're not supposed to be doing.
The FDA seems to think it's okay. Yeah.
It's okay. Yeah. That's nice. Enjoy your chicken nuggets.
So if it weren't for the beef industry, the chicken industry would not be profitable.
That's interesting. That's an interesting accounting.
Someone has to eat their shit.
It's all connected.
Excrement.
Now, my understanding of the business itself is really complicated because companies like Tyson have this whole formula where it's like a franchise almost, where people don't really own their farm, or they kind of sign their life away and they have to do
it's sharecropping, essentially. It's vertical integration of the industry, which began in the poultry industry and then spread to the pork industry and then went into the dairy industry. The beef industry is still largely not consolidated. Most beef cows are still raised by independent farmers and ranchers out on rangeland or pasture land. But then for the last 4 to 6 months of their life, they're sold and sent to feedlots.
To fatten them up.
Where big companies fatten them up on grain and sell them. Whereas dairy cows, pigs, and chickens are kept in feedlots their entire not 100%, but for the most part. And these companies contract out with farmers, and they'll come into an area, and you'll see, basically, then the motto becomes, get big or get out. And if you don't agree to become a contract farmer for these large companies, you'll probably be driven out of business. Because even if you're still growing animals the old-fashioned way, you'll never get them into the processing plant. Because the processing plant wants 5,000 pigs that are all uniform, that all have one half inch of back fat on them, etc., that can be delivered Tuesday the 15th at 5 o'clock, which Farmer Brown just can't do. So he or she can't get their animals to market. That drives people out of business, so farmers get scared, and they're like, gee, if I want to stay on this land, I'm going to have to build a CAFO and contract with Tyson or Purdue or whoever it is, and that's the only way I can stay on my land. And they go and they go way into debt, these buildings and all the mechanism and everything costs about $1.5 million to get started. They assume that debt, and they assume all the liability for those tons and tons of manure that get...
It's a great deal for Tyson.
The company owns the animals, mm-hmm. and that's it. They drop them off one day as babies, and they pick them up at an appointed time and date, 7, 10, 12 weeks later, whatever, as ready for market, and they give them a check for every animal that survives. And we were talking about the poultry. You know, I talk about Carol Morrison, who was a Purdue contractor. They were making about $6,000 a year per house, per chicken house, and they were breaking their butts. Mm-hmm. And they were getting about 50 cents a chicken. And they couldn't eat their own chickens. Even if, you know, Carol would have to go in and cull out the ones that just weren't growing fast enough, that weren't going to make it to market weight on time, and kill them, but she had to compost them. She could not eat them. Even after the company came and the chicken catchers came, which is a horrible ordeal to catch these chickens and cram them into cages, there's always 5, 10, 20 chickens that were left in the dark corners that got away. Well, she would have to go in and kill them and compost them because those belonged to Purdue. If she and her family had eaten one of those chickens, they would have lost their contract and possibly prosecuted for larceny. If they want a chicken, they get in the car, they drive down to the supermarket, and they pay for a Purdue chicken like everybody else. If that is not farming, period, that's sharecropping. You don't get to decide what the chickens eat. You don't get to decide when they go to market. You don't get to decide what temperature the barn is, how much water. It is all dictated by the company.
And when Tyson has upgrades, you have to upgrade.
Upgrade or get out.
Right. And so you're just deep, deep, deep in debt, and there's like no way out.
No. And if you have a lagoon spill, you're responsible, not the company.
Yeah. Well, I'm not getting in that business. For a lot of reasons. Okay, so the thing that's not obvious is the fish, because the pig and dairy and poultry farms aren't about growing fish, but they certainly have a big impact on fish life.
Yes, they do. Marine life in general, anything that lives in the water.
Right.
Very big impact.
And sometimes those that are responsible don't want to make that connection.
Or they deny it. They say that these are state of the art. You hear that all the time, that my lagoon has a liner, that I apply my liquid waste at agronomic levels. And look, there are good farmers out there. I mean, in fact, there's bad farmers too. I don't blame the farmers. I blame the system. But I've been up in the air in airplanes, and I've seen people out on their fields just over. In other words, it's not fertilizer, it's waste management. It's like, how do we get rid of all this manure? So they apply it and reapply it and overapply it. And I've seen saturated fields.
Mm-hmm. They
know what they're doing. And they have to file reports with the state, and it's all very technical. And, you know, X tons of waste that had X tons of nitrogen, and we put it on X number of acres, and it was absorbed at this rate, and blah, blah, blah. And look, we lowered our lagoon by 2 feet to show that everything is okay, and they're doing it all by the book. But in reality, that's just not the case. I sometimes they spray the waste directly into creeks or ditches just to get rid of it. Or, again, they apply it at such a heavy rate that it just runs off.
Is there a part of it where people that are the activists or are fighting for something better are threatened? Their lives are threatened? Does it get that dark and scandalous?
Their safety has been put into danger. I don't know if their lives have been threatened. I don't know anybody who's gotten a death threat.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a lot of hostility and a lot of tension in these towns because, of course, some people support the CAFOs. Not everybody's opposed to them, and that can lead to very sad rending apart of communities over these issues. But there's been no violence to my knowledge.
Okay. So how would you do it differently?
Well, I don't think we can or will ban CAFOs overnight, factory farms. It's not going to happen. I think they're here for the long run. So as long as they're going to be with us, we need to make them as environmentally friendly as we can and as animal friendly as we can. The very basics, which some states have started to do, to ban the battery cages for the laying hens, to the gestation crates for the pigs, the veal crates for the baby calves. I mean, these are really inhumane and just abominable. So those should be abolished nationally across the board. But more importantly is to revitalize and regenerate the independent, truly independent, small and medium-sized form of agriculture that can work side by side with the big companies. They can. And it's consumers who are going to help drive it quite a bit. So I see, you know, an opening. I see consumer demand for products that are raised sustainably and humanely. And I see some government policies working to try to support that. But there's going to be, I think consumer sentiment and demand is going to help change things. I think two things outside of our control will make a difference. One is more emerging diseases. If these just keep coming at us, eventually people are going to say, we can't raise our animals. I think the real blow is energy prices and oil prices. And everybody's saying how expensive food is now. That's because everything is petroleum-based. And a factory farm relies on petroleum to fertilize all the corn and grain and everything, those cheap subsidized feed, and the pesticides to grow all that food. They need electricity to light the buildings, to heat the buildings, to cool the buildings, to run all the machinery, all of the vehicles, so heavily energy intensive. And then they need energy to get the animals to the slaughter and then to get them across the country to market. That's just going to keep going up and up and up. And pretty soon, farmers are going to say, wait a minute, there's got to be an alternative. I'm spending so much money on electricity and fertilizer and pesticides and blah, 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 and I got this contract, and I'm not making any more money per animal, and yet my costs are just going up and up and up. This is untenable. So what happens? Along with consumer demand for small, local, independent, humane, sustainable, all of those things, which we now have in New York. I have it at the Park Slope Food Co-op. We now have farmers markets all over town, and they're just getting in gear now for spring, thank God, with a lot more fresh fruits and vegetables and meat and dairy products and eggs. People are demanding those more. And I've been interviewing a lot of farmers who have now gone back to completely traditional ways of animal agriculture, and they're making more money than they were in a CAFO operation, because they, instead of planting all of their land for corn that nobody's going to eat, just the animals, they put the animals out there and they rote them. And the cows go first and they forage and they eat everything down. And then the chickens and the pigs come in after them and they grub and they eat everything down to the soil, keep the soil super healthy. Meanwhile, their urine and manure is going back into the soil and being ground up and naturally broken down. The pathogens are dying in the sunlight. There's no disease. The animals don't get sick, so you don't have to use pesticides, you don't have to use fertilizers, you don't have to use antibiotics. And the crops grow really, really well because the soil is fertile, and it's all free. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, I mean, obviously labor is your big cost and some other costs. But he's saving so much money on all those externals, on all those inputs, and then he gets a really good price for his free-range animals. And his delicious pork and his grass-fed beef, that he, as he put it, I put two and two together and I got five.
Okay, this is definitely a better situation. I, as a vegan, I'm not into promoting the consumption of animal foods, but I know people are going to do it, and if they're going to do it, that's the way to have them raised. I think one of the reasons that we confine animals is to make a lot of them.
Yes.
And so if everyone was going to raise animals for meat and eggs and dairy in a natural way, we wouldn't have the quantities that we have.
No, we wouldn't. And there would be higher prices and people would
right.
eat less of it,
so,
which would be good for them.
Exactly. So right now it's working out. These small farmers, those that choose to do it, are doing reasonably well because the savvy consumer, the one that can afford it, is demanding these products. But at some point, there's going to be people are going to have to eat less. That's the bottom line.
We eat, even the USDA says the average American male eats 75% more animal protein than he should. Average female, 35% more protein. So we could cut almost in half and still be getting more, a lot of protein,
right.
Probably more than we should. And in my own personal experience, it's funny because I do eat a lot less meat because I buy it at the co-op and it's grass-fed and it's expensive.
Mm-hmm.
it's cheaper at the co-op than it is other places. I can't even imagine. So because it's expensive, I use it sparingly. I use it for flavorings, as people talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Or instead of having one chicken breast for each people, four people at dinner, I'll take one breast and slice it up and mix it with vegetables. I just saved three chicken breasts of consumption and production, et cetera, et cetera. So I find it's a bit more of a treat for me. It tastes so much better. I'm willing to wait for it when I do eat it. So I find that I do eat a lot less meat under this arrangement, but the fruits and vegetables are so delicious there that I rely more heavily on them. And then ironically... I think we were talking, I bought some pork the other day. I haven't bought pork in 10 years, for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
I don't eat it, largely for ethical reasons, because I think pigs are really great, smart animals.
Mm-hmm.
But also just because it wasn't raised in a healthy environment, and I knew,
Especially where you knew all about.
Especially what I knew, I just completely just, there's no way. And I just bought some, pasture-raised upstate Berkshire ground pork. And then I just found out there's a sustainable veal company, and I haven't eaten veal at all, probably since I was a kid. Veal has such a bad rap, but all it really is a young cow. And we slaughter veal calves at an older age than we slaughter pigs and chickens.
That's a really interesting subject. For me, once again, I don't believe in killing any animals, okay? For me, it's all the same. And when I hear people cringing about eating one animal part versus another, to me, it's all the same.
Yeah, sure.
So it doesn't make any sense, and it's a really good point. A baby animal versus an adult animal, exploitation, pain and suffering, it's all the same to me. Okay.
Sorry, I didn't mean to upset you.
No, I have to say it for the animals. But I'm just wondering which is going to come first, the chicken or the egg, if I may. There are so many different issues pointing to people eating less meat. So is it just going to become so cost prohibitive for even factory farming because of energy, and or is it going to become an environmental issue because the global warming is so impacted, and all of the environmental issues, air and water and soil, because it's so devastating? Or is it because everybody's going to make the connected dots and say, I have heart disease because I'm eating too much meat?
I think all of the above, but I think it's going to be a slow and gradual process.
A slow, painful process.
This is not a revolution, it's an evolution. And I think one thing that could really change things a lot is federal subsidies, because that really supports the factory farm system more than anything, particularly in the form of corn and soybeans that are any kind of animal feed that we pay for. You pay for. You don't eat meat.
I don't want to pay for it.
But you're paying to feed those animals. You're paying a lot of money to feed those animals. And in this time of federal budget deficits, it seems like to me, forgive me, but this is the low-hanging fruit. This is the easy stuff. Multimillionaires getting hundreds of thousands of dollars every year in farm subsidies. They live on Park Avenue.
Yeah.
And, it's there was an effort recently in Congress to cap subsidies at $250,000 a year. That failed. The Tea Party voted against it, even though they're supposed to be against wasteful government spending. And then if you look at the food pyramid, you know, how at the bottom is fruits and vegetables, and then come the grains, and then come the meats, or whatever, the dairy, and at the very top is the meats. If you, it's completely inverted.
Right.
78% of subsidies go to meat and dairy. And you know what percentage? This is according to the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. If you look at all farm subsidies and all the amount that goes to feed and to CAFOs, 78%. At the very, very tip of the pyramid is fruits and vegetables, even less than oils and seeds and nuts.
Oh, it's nutty.
And it gets 0.38% of every subsidy dollar. So less than a third of a penny, a third of a penny of every tax dollar goes to fruits and vegetables.
Well, it's very obvious that it's all related to money, and so maybe this is our only hope. But the question is, how do we get our politicians to support reversing subsidies? You know, those farmers that are getting this. Well, is it just the farmers that are getting subsidies for doing nothing, or is it the farmers that are getting subsidies for making the wrong stuff?
Well, I'm actually going to write about this for the Huffington Post. Like I said, that vote. If 29 members of Congress had switched sides and voted for the subsidy cap, it would have passed.
Wow.
Now, it would be harder in the Senate to get through. Obama has vowed to sign such legislation. He made that promise in his campaign. So it could happen. And, you know, they're going to bring it up again and again and again. And if you look at some of who those people are who voted against the caps, not just the Tea Party, but on the Democratic side, we had like five members of Congress from New York City who voted against food subsidy caps. There's no farms in New York City.
Right.
You know, Elliot Engel and Nydia Velasquez.
Okay, call your representatives, call your senators, and get them to turn this subsidy triangle on its head. Okay,
right.
We've got a minute.
Okay.
And you have a new book coming out.
I'm working on a new book. It'll be out summer 2012. It's called Death at SeaWorld. It's about the trainer who was killed there last year as a way of looking into the whole captive orca industry, which is another form of animal exploitation. That's orcas are much smarter than cows or even pigs.
And probably us.
Probably us.
Thank you. You've been listening to It's All About Food with my guest David Kirby. Please pick up his Animal Factory, now out in paperback today, and go to animalfactorybook.com. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Have a delicious week.